tonight on Arena. Katie Tunstall on what it takes to become a real artist and a new play about Adolf Hitler's nephew who had an Irish mother. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. To Scottish singer-songwriter Katie Tunstall first this evening. She's coming over to play at the brilliant Night and Day Festival in Lough Key in Roscommon this summer, as well as a night in Dolan's in Limerick, and that's in June. Her songs, Black Horse and the Cherry Tree and Suddenly I See, are instantly recognisable, but it was an album by the great Patti Smith which inspired Katie Tunstall to be a true artist and changed everything for her. Before we hear about that, let's remind ourselves of one of her biggest hits, Suddenly I See. Suddenly I See from Katie Tunstall, and I'm absolutely delighted to have Katie join me from Santa Fe this evening here on Arena. I mean, that song, I think everybody knows that Patti Smith was such a huge inspiration to you, particularly in terms of the lyrics for that song, but in terms of her general attitude to music and to being the star that she is. When did you pick up the Horses album and look at that cover picture of Patti Smith and say, do you know what? This is what I want to be, as it says in the chorus there.
It's so lovely that you know that story, Sean. And for anyone who might not, I was sitting in my basement flat in London before I'd released a record, and the record label had said this awful line that they sometimes say to artists, which is, we need more singles. And it's just the worst thing you can hear. And so, and then you're sort of tearing your hair out, you know, because you write songs for yourself. You don't write them to write a single. Well, I don't anyway. And and then, of course, you sit there and you end up writing a single. But I was looking at this album, which I was familiar with, and I'd seen, you know, I knew the Robert Mapplethorpe amazing black and white photo of Patti Smith on the cover. And I was just sitting at 2 a.m, looking at my CD collection, going, how do I become one of these people who has her own CD? And this picture of her is just staring at me, just going, I am not trying. You know, she's just, there's no effort. She's just being herself. And it was just a real epiphany where I just thought, you're wasting energy trying to be something. Just be it.
Yeah.
Just own it. And that was a real kind of changing point in my attitude towards what I was doing.
It's easy to, you know, to look at somebody and that photograph is a perfect example of it. There are other examples out there and say, you know, they're doing nothing there. They're just being themselves and saying, here I am.
I know.
If you don't want me, good luck. I'll see you around. It takes a lot of confidence, however, to get yourself to the point. How difficult a trip was it for you to get to that stage where you say, you know, this is Katie Tunstall. If you don't like her, goodbye.
That's exactly right, Sean. And it's easier said than done, right? Mm. And it's so interesting. There's that whole idea that the first half of your life, you need to have a big, strong ego to pursue the things you love. And then the second half of your life, you've got to start stripping it away so that you can enjoy it, you know? And I think that's exactly what was going on, where you're looking for sort of outside validation, but that's really not where artistry comes from. It's got to come from the inside, and it's got to come from a place where you don't really care what people think. Mm. It's taken me a long time to get there. I think I really only really just got there. But along the way, I managed to kind of sort the wheat from the chaff with my ideas and my albums, where I was like, I know this is what is pleasing me, and it might not please other people, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I'm really glad I kind of followed that path the whole time.
The other side of it is, of course, you know, you didn't listen to Horses, the 1975 album that this picture we're talking about is on. You didn't listen to that over and over again and say, and you know what, I'm going to make music like that as well. You had to make your own music, not somebody else's music. But how much of an inspiration was Patti Smith to you musically and the style of what she did musically?
I mean, probably not as much as some other artists. It was really her. Mm. It was really her disposition and her attitude and her image, and the energy around her. You know, I loved a quote of hers where she said, "Even if you're writing about something negative, make it a positive force in the world." And that's a real lesson in intention. You know, you're not using hate and sort of, you know, revenge as your drivers. It's like the driver is actually getting through that stuff to the other side.
And then there's the other aspect of suddenly I see that we've just been listening to the rhythm guitar. The confidence of your voice. I should say the confidence and the sheen that's off your voice as you sing there. It's just there's a wonderful energy in it. But that guitar is there alongside you, almost like a part of you, encouraging you along with those wonderful rhythms that you pull out of it.
Well, thank you so much. And it's a huge compliment, but it is like a fifth limb. I just, you know, I learned to sing while I was playing guitar at the same time. And I'll tell you what, it is the most awkward thing when I've got to put the guitar down and sing. And I'm like, what do you do with your hands? But yeah, it's really that's busking. Yeah. It was learning to play on the street, having to stop people. You know, grab their attention, try and get their attention as they're walking past. And you know, I look back at Eddie Cochran and Elvis and the Everly Brothers, and they were just such amazing rhythm guitar players. And so you actually, your guitar ends up being your whole band. Mm. It's your drums, it's your bass, and it's your guitar.
But I believe Bo Diddley was a particular inspiration in terms of rhythm you're playing there.
For sure. So it's the Bo Diddley beat. I think he started recording when he was 11 years old. And that beat was actually called the Hambone beat, because the musicians didn't have drums, so they used to slap their thighs and their chests in these rhythms and make these amazing rhythms with their bodies, and it was called the Hambone beat. And then Bo Diddley recorded with it, and it became his, and he kind of he basically commandeered it as his own, and then we all copied it. You know, U2 with Desire, George Michael with Faith, me with Suddenly I See. So it's on the shoulders of giants.
Now when I was a little boy, at the age of 5, I had something in my pocket, keep a lot of folks alive. Now I'm a man, May 21, you know, baby, we can have a lot of fun.
You know, when you listen to Suddenly I See, I think there's something that links it back to old blues music, and that's you feel it in the music, and that's how the kind of storytelling of songwriting works.
But the other thing that strikes me about that song, and it's there on lots of songs across your output, yes, you have quieter and slower songs, of course they are there, but Suddenly I See, ironically, is quite an introspective song. But it's so joyous. Yeah. It's so joyous in that introspection. You know, you weren't a lonely singer-songwriter, navel-gazing, looking down at your guitar, playing the softest minor key chords that you could find, you know, so that you could look inside yourself and find yourself. It really is a celebration.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Sean. Those open mic nights drove me mental. I just hated it. It was just like being in a therapy session that I wasn't paying for. It was like, I have not chosen to listen to all these other people's grievances. But, you know, I think the most powerful songwriting does come from struggle and pain. And I learned from listening to bands like Fleetwood Mac that they don't have to sound depressing. You know, you listen to the lyrics of their stuff and it's full of struggle and full of heartache, but you can dance along with a beer if you want, or you can listen to the lyrics and go, oh man, they were going through some stuff. They just crafted it in a way that kind of disguises the difficulty a lot of the time. And I think, you know, Suddenly I See is very much about struggle. But it's sung in a way that you can dance to.
Absolutely, it's an upbeat struggle, and I suppose.
Listen, if we can dance to our pain and struggle through this life, then we're winning.
Well, it was that great eureka moment where you saw what you wanted to be, and you thought, and you know, I see it in front of me here. I see it, therefore I can be it. But hearing it, I guess, is another part of it. If you can hear it, can you be it? I'm kind of surprised to hear how much of that Tom Waits, and particularly the record Bone Machine, was quite
an
influence on you, because I mean That's a gravelly, lived-in, tired, whiskey-soaked voice.
I am so thrilled of how much research you've done for the interview. It's just wonderful having these things come up because they rarely come up. But when I'd gone to college, I had a little hippie goth friend called Candice, and she used to play bongos when I was playing guitar. And she said, Katie, you've got to listen to Tom Waits. Just go and get a CD. So it was the college CD fair. And I just grabbed the first one I could find, and it was Bone Machine. And it absolutely altered the trajectory of the music that I made, because here was this guy. The other thing was, there wasn't really a picture of him. It's a weird picture on the front. And I thought he was a black guy. I thought he was a black blues singer.
Because of the sound of his voice.
And then I find out that he's, you know, this kind of gruff white guy, and I was like, oh wow, we can all borrow from blues, and you can just allow these things to inspire you and make themselves part of your makeup. Album in particular, it was just like, you know, why go into an expensive studio and spend all that money on making a drum sound like a cardboard box when it's just like, just use a cardboard box. Just use a welly boot and a cardboard box.
And off you go.
And it sounds so cool to do that because it's actually, it's really, sorry for the pun, but it's outside the box. It's like be taking the risk of using unconventional ways of making sounds. And when I listen back to, you know, when I hear Suddenly I See your Black Horse and the Cherry Tree playing in the supermarket, it sounds different from everything else. And I love that.
And do you find yourself in the supermarket going, wanting to tap somebody on the shoulder at the shelf beside you, say, you know, that's me there.
Yeah, believe me, there are selfie videos of me dancing around Lululemon. Singing karaoke to my own tune. It's still a thrill.
Yeah, well, there you go. And despite all of that, I've heard you speaking about living with tinnitus, you know, which for anyone who doesn't know what an awful condition it is, how do you describe, is it a noise? What are you hearing in your head that's interfering with everything? And is it constantly there?
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, when the TV programming ends, which it probably doesn't ever now. I think that's probably a thing of the past.
In the olden days.
It's that tone where the TV turns off, it says, doo, and it's just playing the whole time in your head. And the other difficulty I have is that I lost my hearing completely on my left side in 2018. My ear just gave up. The other ear is doing great, thankfully. But I've actually got tinnitus in my deaf ear. So that's all I've got on that side. And, you know, it's a mindset. You've just got, I think anybody, it really just made me understand how wonderful people are who have disabilities that just get on with their life. And it's like, you just have to decide that it's not going to stop you from a mental perspective.
Yeah, I think you've said that it's a concert C. It's a perfect C, the note C that is playing.
It used to be.
Has it shifted?
And it's shifted. It's now more of a kind of white noise, higher pitch thing, but I think I've just kind of tuned it out a little bit. But the thing is, it actually gets much worse when you're very tired. And if you're getting exhausted or stressed out. And so it's actually quite a good little alarm system these days of just going, you know what, Katie, you need to chill out. Just take a day off.
I was delighted to see and hear about your writing the music for the stage recently, the musical version.
What a great experience.
This is the film version the musical version rather, of Amy Heckerling's film Clueless.
I thought that I was in control, as if thought I was really on a roll, as if I thought that I knew best and never guessed which way the cards would fall. I really thought I knew it all, as if I thought I'd help a friend in need, yeah right. Thought I could nobly intercede, not quite. And when it went awry, that she found a guy who was a man for her. At least I never thought they were as if.
What was the joy of that? Because it seems very different from you and your one-man band guitar.
Well, yeah, the first part is that you're a team. Mm. So every person, the director, the lighting designer, the set designer, the lyric writer, you know, we're all top of our game. Mm. And we've all been chosen because we really know what we're doing. So you're really getting inspired by, you know, this amazing choreographer who can get 20 kids doing a routine in 10 minutes, you know. And then... secondly, because of the nature of Clueless, the movie set in the 90s, I really wanted to use that as sort of the North Star of what we were making. So I was going to all of these hits of the 90s, you know, NSYNC, Alanis Morissette, Beastie Boys, Coolio, you know, Natalie Imbruglia, just amazing songs, and really delving into the production of those songs. So every song in the musical is an homage to a big hit like Green Day,
right,
you know, that happened at the time. So you can, once you know, you can hear them. But if you're not kind of analyzing how the songs are sounding, you're basically listening to a mixtape of 90s bangers, but they're actually new songs.
Yeah, yeah. But again, I suppose that's having the confidence to say, that's what I want. I mean, you did say there, we are talking about yourself and all the others involved, we all know what we're doing. I'm guessing before you looked back in the day in that basement flat of yours at that CD cover of Patti Smith, you couldn't have said that. You wouldn't have had the self ability to say it.
That's right. You've got to do some searching to find out what it is you want to say and how you want to say it. Because there's so many musicians, there's so many greats before you. There's so many mediocre people before you who tried. And you've really got to find your own way of expressing yourself. And I love that the quote that says, you know, why try and be like your idol? They're always going to have done it better than you can.
Yeah.
There's no point in trying to emulate people. They've done it better. You take inspiration from these people. But I always say, when people ask, like, what's the best bit of advice you can give? I often just say that the thing that you think is the weirdest thing about you might just be your superpower when it comes to being an artist. The thing that people are saying, ooh, you need to tone that down, or you need to change that, that doesn't sound normal. It's like, well, you don't want to sound normal. You want to sound like you. And what makes you sound like you?
Yeah, those things. And nobody's going to be better at sounding like Katie Tunstall than Katie Tunstall. Let's face it.
That's right.
You're going to be able to do
exactly
it.
Exactly right. So, well, I hope so. If someone else does it better than me, then I'm in trouble.
Yeah, you sure are. Well, maybe they are, because they should be looking for themselves rather than trying to be you. I guess that resilience is what has brought you through, you know, a music career that is still very active, and coming to do these gigs that you're coming to do in Ireland, the Night and Day Festival in Lochkey and Dolan's in Limerick. You clearly just get a buzz out of that up there in front of the audience, small and big, to perform.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for mentioning that as well. The resilience, I think, is maybe the most important part. You know, it's no walk in the park trying to be a musician for a living. And, you know, people often say to me, oh, is it harder being a woman? I'm like, no, it's hard being a musician. It's just hard. If you were a girl and you wanted to be a boxer, you're going to have to get into the ring and get punched in the face. Hmm. That's just how it works. You're going to have to be resilient. You're going to have to grow a thicker skin. It's not an easy business. And I've really enjoyed that fight. I'm a bit of a honey badger, so I've really enjoyed that challenge. And then, you know, coming for these gigs, I can't wait for these gigs in Ireland. You know, one is a festival, which is my Night and Day, which is going to be, it's my favourite gig to do as a festival. But I also love playing a pub.
Yeah.
It's just, there's nothing like a knees up where you can see everybody's face and you can hear what everybody's shouting at you. It's just so much fun.
So this other piece of information that I read about you wanting to learn ceramics, you're not quite going that. Are you going into the quiet route, or is that just something totally outside of work?
not quite there. I'm like turning the corner where I can actually, you know, with Clueless getting up. Clueless is like doing the musical theatre. It's a great kind of left turn into something different. And, you know, touring is hard on the body as you get older. It's definitely a young man's game. And so doing things that mean I can spend a little bit more time learning new stuff, being at home and hanging out with my Irish wolfhound.
And why not? Irish wolfhound has a name?
Irish wolfhound is called Flo. It's wolf backwards. And then we've got a little husky and we've got a tiny little miniature pincher. And guess who's in charge?
I'm guessing it's not the Irish wolfhound. That's for
not
sure.
Not the Irish wolfhound, the smallest one.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, just to finish up, I saw you recently, a video of you, it's on YouTube. Where else do we see videos these days? With the great Daryl Hall in his, the live from Daryl's house. Great moment that when you went into his house and sang and played Black Horse and Cherry Tree. That song was still, I mean, it really was the one that started everything, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, you meet people like that. That's the amazing kind of side effect of following your dream and having it work is you get this passport to meet some of these just icons, these people that you are your heroes. And Daryl was just the most extraordinary vocalist, really probably the best male singer I've ever worked with. It's such a huge compliment when they'll, you know, learn a song of yours and sing along to you, which is just, it blows your mind. It still blows my mind. It's amazing. But yeah, that song really was, again, very much from a place of the blues. It's, there's no rock and roll without the blues, Sean.
Yeah, that's true. That is absolutely true. We're going to finish up by listening to Black Horse and the Cherry Tree. And I should warn listeners that if they see a woman in a supermarket dancing around singing to this, it may well be KT Tunstall, yeah?
It might be me.
Katie, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. Thanks for being with us.
You too. Cheers.
All the best. That's Katie Tunstall. And this is Black Horse and the Cherry Tree.
No, 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 no. Said no, no. You're not the one for me. No, no. No.
What a wonderful song. That is Katie Tunstall and Black Horse and the Cherry Tree. Katie will be appearing on the Queen Maeve stage at the Night and Day Festival at Lochkey Forest Park in County Roscommon. That's from the 27th through until the 29th of June, the festival. And the lineup includes Jose Gonzalez, Katie Tunstall, Paul Brady, The Wailers, The Stunning, Lisa Hannigan, Sultans of Ping, Adwith, Fionn Regan. Wow, what a lineup that is. Tickets on sale right now, nightandday.ie. And Katie will also be at Dolan's in Limerick on June the 30th. Tickets from dolans.ie. Let's go back to Weimar Germany, the progressive and liberal world shown in shows like Cabaret and the epitome of the persona of Marlene Dietrich. But there is, as we know, a terrible darkness on the horizon. A brand new play tells the true story of a young man called William Patrick Hitler, who leaves his Irish mother, Bridget, behind in Liverpool to go and meet his uncle, that's his uncle Adolf, for the first time. His uncle will soon be made Chancellor of Germany as William discovers a powerful and dangerous man in question. The real William spent the rest of his life lecturing about the evils of Nazism, but at the beginning of the story, when we meet him, he's just searching for family. Friends in Berlin has just opened at Bewley's Theatre here in Dublin. I'm delighted that the play's director, Michael James Ford, the play's actors, Felix Brown and Kyle Hickson, are with me in studio this evening. And Felix Brown is also the author of the play. Where did you come across Paddy Hitler? I have to call him Paddy Hitler. There's no other name you could be calling him with an Irish mammy.
Well, I did a sort of piece about it in Seen and Heard Festival maybe 2 years ago. Mm. And I actually performed one of the verbatim pieces, like the lectures he did when he was much older. And I sort of performed it like a TED talk, really. And then Michael, without me even knowing, was in the audience and saw it. I didn't even invite him, but he was there. And he said to me, listen, this is an amazing story. I don't think anyone knows it. We should turn it into a play. And then basically after that, we started the task of developing it into like a proper two-hander, essentially.
Had you any knowledge of the story, Michael, when you
really
saw that
vague
TED talk? Were you aware of the early part of Patrick's life?
Just the Alois and the Shelburne.
Alois was his dad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all. And just this.
So tell us about Alois and the Shelburne.
Well, we'll hear an excerpt which tells you that.
Yes. Well, I suppose we need to lay out a little bit more then before we hear that extract. So we have Felix is you're playing the character of William.
Yes.
William Patrick Hitler himself. We shouldn't leave poor Tom over who's the other character played by Kyle. Kyle's surname has gone off my page from in front of me. Okay. I just can't see it.
Hickson.
Kyle Hickson. Thank you, Kyle.
No worries.
Kyle is playing the character of Tom. Tom is a fictional character in the midst of all of this. Maybe you'd explain where he fits in. You can do it.
Well, I suppose Tom is kind of an amalgamation of a couple of different real people that Felix researched. So I guess I had a lot of license actually to kind of create a character. But, you know, it's a really lovely script that Felix has written. So, like, you know, it really was kind of all on the page. So Tom is an Englishman living in Berlin. He's a diplomat, and he is he's left Berlin to kind of, I suppose, he's left England, I suppose, to kind of create a new life for himself
in Berlin.
In Berlin, yeah, exactly, yeah.
And this Tom character and William Patrick as even effectively what you have, Felix, it's a way of William Patrick being able to tell his story
to us,
the audience, but he's doing it with Tom, and there's a lot of energy, a lot of tension between the two men. So you're going to perform this first extract for us, which is William telling how his mother and his father met.
Yes, this is what, from the first scene when William and Patrick have just met, essentially, and Tom is asking William, you know...
William and Tom, yeah.
How did you come here? Why did you come here? And how did your parents meet?
Right. So let us hear then the answers that he gets.
Well, it's quite an interesting story, really. You see, my parents met in Dublin. My mother, Bridget, and that whole side of the family are from there. And my father was working in Dublin at the time. And they both attended the Dublin Horse Show. It's this great big deal over there. And my mother was absolutely taken by this mysterious German man in an ivory suit.
An ivory suit?
Yes, and he asked my grandparents' permission to take my mother out for the day, and he took her to the National Gallery of Ireland. It's this beautiful building right in the middle of town.
Now I'm starting to see where you get it from.
So here's the funny thing. So my father had told my mother that he was a prominent businessman working in the hotel industry, when about two or three nights later, my mother was eating in the Shelburne Hotel. And who did she see scrubbing dishes in the back?
No.
My father. He was actually a kitchen porter. He didn't have a penny to his name.
And she stayed with him?
Well, I think by that time, she was already in love with him.
There we go. Kyle Hickson and Felix Brown. Felix, the author, playing the character of William Patrick Hitler, and Kyle Hickson playing the character of Tom. Two young Englishmen, as they are, in Berlin, just at that point in time before things went absolutely crazy, I suppose, and very, very dark subsequent to that. How do the events, Michael James Ford, who's the director, how do the events of what was happening in Europe and what was happening in Germany, how do they feed into the story of William Patrick Hitler?
Well, what you find is that William Patrick, who's there, wide-eyed, he's been distracted by all the wonders of the Berlin nightlife, but things are starting to, the darker side is starting to bleed in, like he learns through Tom, who's much more streetwise, about the SA thugs wandering around the streets. He learns about the rise of the Nazi party. He knows a little bit about his uncle, but he doesn't know that much. And then we have an extraordinary scene where he actually meets his uncle. And then he starts to lean on him because he thinks this man becomes chancellor. He should be helping his family. William has grown up in terrible poverty, just with his mother having been abandoned by the half-brother.
Who was the half-brother, actually, of Hitler, I should explain.
And so he's on the make. He's trying to see what he can get out of his relationship with his uncle.
And I guess, Felix, that is that one of the aspects of, I'm going to call him Paddy, because William makes him sound like somebody else, Paddy Hitler, William Patrick, how one of the aspects is that initially I mean, he's kind of, as so many people were at the time, taken in by the charisma of the uncle, by the power of the uncle, his Uncle Adolf.
Yep. I think what you have to keep in mind as well is that at the time that William goes to Berlin, it's so early on. You know, I think we already now know the horrors of who Adolf was and everything he did. But I guess in 1928, it was kind of unaware of what he was and who he was going to sort of become. In William's eyes, he'd grown up in poverty and basically he learns through his father that his uncle is this rising star in politics. He's got all this power and all this money. And I think it was a very kind of childhood want to kind of reconnect with his father who'd left him quite young. And I think that was kind of the want and need as of him to go over and to sort of benefit from it, you know, so essentially.
He has an extended family there. We'll come particularly to his cousin. Mm-hmm. Again, based, this is fact that we're about to hear about that. But before we go to that, I want to talk a little bit more, if I could, Kyle, with you about how the relationship between William Patrick and your character, Tom, how that begins to develop. There's a lot of sexual tension between the two men. Now, Weimar might have been a little bit more accepting of two gay men in an open relationship at that time, but it wasn't for sure what was coming wasn't going to be accepting of homosexuality.
No, definitely not. You know, I think Tom and William have quite a complex relationship in the play. I think when Tom first meets him, he sees a bit of himself in William and kind of wants to show this new guy, you know, around Berlin and weirdly kind of protect him as well from the political climate. And then I think he ends up kind of falling in love with him. And then that kind of drives him even more to want to protect him.
But there is that aspect that I suppose what can be played and is played out in the play to a certain extent, but kind of a cat and mouse thing where they can't openly say to each other the nature of their sexuality for fear that either one of them could get the other one in trouble for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is something we end up kind of exploring in the play through Tom, that, you know, at this time, he ends up kind of being leaned on and blackmailed about his sexuality in the play to essentially spy on William's character.
I think the second section that you're going to play gives us a sense of that kind of tension between the two of them.
Yep.
It's not truth or dare that they're playing, but it's a kind of a true or false. Is that the nature of the game here?
Well, the kind of game truth or dare hadn't really been invented yet, but there are like some little rumours of early versions of it. And, you know, we had a little bit dramatic licence to put it in there as well. Yeah.
So this is the two of them. What point are we at in the play when this interaction is taking
place? This is the sort of second scene. It's maybe 1931, roughly.
And it's late at night. They've had a few drinks and they're going out for more.
So now it's time, are you telling the truth or are you telling a big fat fib?
Okay, let's play a game while we drink.
A game?
Yes. Tell a truth or tell a lie. One person either says something that is true or a lie, and the other person has to guess which one it is.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Oh, come on, it will be fun. I will go first. Other than English and German, I can speak another language. French.
French? I don't know. True?
False. I can just speak English and German.
Tom, this is stupid.
Oh, come on. The first one's never that much fun.
Is this what you and your friends at the embassy do?
Come on. Your turn.
I got sacked from my first job in an accountancy firm in London.
I'm going to say true.
Correct, I did.
2 points for me.
Ugh.
My turn. Since I arrived here, I have never gone back to England.
No, it can't be true. False.
True.
You've never gone back?
Your turn.
In 6 years?
It's not the game to explain the answers.
All right. Mystery man. I've never been in love.
True.
You're good at this.
Thank you. My turn. I have spilt a beer over the lap of the former Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin.
Seems too specific to be false. True.
False.
Oh, I give up.
Oh, come on.
Terrible
one more
at this.
Come on.
I'm having a homosexual relationship with my boss at work. How's that?
If you're not going to take it seriously, then let's not play.
Who says I'm not taking it seriously?
I told you that in confidence.
All right. It's just a silly joke. I'm sorry.
Yes, I forgot how funny you are.
Kyle Hixon and Felix Brown there in a scene from Felix's play Friends in Berlin. And Michael James Ford, director, is with us along with writers and the two actors this evening. you know, when we hear some of those things, you can hear, yeah, of course, they're playing around with each other, and the final little encounter there is where they're almost telling each other the nature of their love for each other, essentially, is what we find out. But the backdrop here, it's there all the time. There are just little hints of it. How do you manage, you know, what's coming is horrendous. How do you manage giving the audience a sense of that and creating that tension behind the ordinary events of these two men chatting, Michael?
I think it's by making the friendship the story. They're just making the journey of that friendship between the two, where some of the horrific things become reported, but they're not necessarily part of the dramatic line. So one of the big events is William's cousin, Gelly.
Gelly, yes. And this is based, in fact. This is what I was talking about.
And he's
about.
Completely taken with her because she's glamorous and rich, and she takes him round to the best clubs in Berlin. But more and more, he's aware that her uncle Adolf is sort of keeping her almost under house arrest in Munich. He doesn't want her out there.
Yeah, and the nature of that relationship, Felix, it's quite dark. The obsession of the uncle for the niece.
And it's in history. There's lots of different stories about it. But I think a lot of people have openly said that they were almost in a relationship, essentially, and towards the end, you know, that he essentially was keeping her prisoner, and then she very mysteriously dies at the age of 23. And I think that, for William, is kind of the catalyst to realise that things are not as they seem, that, you know, this kind of world is kind of broken in a little bit. And then she's the person who shows him around Berlin, and they were very close. And I think when she dies, that's when he starts to realise things are wrong with Adolf, you know.
Yeah, and it really does. Again, there's a darkness in that, and the gun by which she dies. Yeah. There are questions around who owned the gun,
yeah,
and how would the gun even have been,
yeah,
in her apartment at the time. It really is a fascinating kind of ordinary story of two friends, and obviously the Tom character is fictional, albeit made up of you know, a conglomeration of people. An ordinary story against a momentous time in history, Michael. I suppose that's its attraction ultimately.
Yeah, and it's been great with the early audiences, how it works as a thriller. As the tension you're talking about increases, and suddenly Tom realizes, with the Nazis in power, a gay man is no longer safe, and he's urging William to leave. William's, by this time, has lent on his uncle and has got a really good job. His salary has been doubled. So there's this, will I stay or will I go?
Yeah, aspect to things. But there's also having the name Hitler.
Yeah.
I mean, he has that name.
Yeah.
And I guess every time that name is mentioned, and indeed even my uncle is mentioned, and the audience are more than aware who your uncle is, there must be a kind of attention and frisson within the audience at that,
well,
Felix.
Well, definitely. I mean, I think that's one of the good things about the play, and when you do true life stories, is that the audience already are so clued into everything, and you can really play with the dramatic irony of that. You know, even in the first revelation, in the first scene, when Tom realizes William's full name and his surname is Hitler, you know, and William's going, I don't see what the big deal is. Obviously, the audience are sat there going, you will see what the big deal is. Yeah.
And it's hardly surprising then that William changed his surname very quickly after the war.
To Houston.
What was the name that he took on board?
Houston.
Houston, okay. Yeah, because, I mean, whatever about having the name Hitler in Weimar, Germany, having the name Hitler in post-war anywhere, Europe or America, was going to be a major problem. You've already opened today. You opened today?
Yeah.
So there you go.
So we're off to our opening party
now.
Your opening night party now.
Whereas it should have been an opening afternoon party. Well, listen, thank you for not having the party until post this interview, and for coming into us this evening. That is the play Friends in Berlin, directed, as I said, by Michael James Forward, starring Felix Brown and Kyle Hixon, both of whom are here this evening, written by Felix, and is running at Beauty's Cafe Theatre 1 p.m. through until the 31st of May, and a soiree performance at 7 p.m. on Friday, May the 23rd. You can find out full details and information on beautyscafetheatre.com. Come. Now, during the pandemic, there were those of us who were working, there were those who were working on the front line and those with the arguably slightly easier option of staying at home, making banana bread and trying to homeschool children. Not so writer Gethin Dick. She's Belfast-born, Marseille-based artist and writer. She spent lockdown in a hut on the side of Mont Saint-Victoire, the famous mountain which obsessed Cézanne. After a career as a visual artist, she has just published her debut novel, Water in the Desert, Fire in the Night, with Tramp Press. It's been described as bold and brilliant, explores a post-apocalyptic world through the lens of three characters, an underachieving millennial, a retired midwife, and a charismatic Dubliner. A few other characters involved there as well. Delighted that Gethin Dick is with me in studio this evening. And I don't think it's the career as an artist is still running alongside the writer. In fact, a lot of your work as a visual artist has a text base to it. I think that has always been important to you, Gethin.
Yeah, it does. I mean, very long time ago, did an MA in creative writing at Goldsmiths University in London. That was in 2001. Mm. And then I think I got maybe slightly frustrated with the way with literature, you have this gap between having made something and having an acknowledgement that it's made. Mm. So after that MA, I kept writing, but I wrote for performance or I wrote for zines that
so
I or friends published. Exactly.
A more immediate sharing of the text that
exactly.
you
were reading. Exactly. And then I studied at Camberwell College of Art and started making kind of text-based visual arts. And so, words have and stories have always had a place in the visual arts.
Yeah, I've said that what we get in the new novel is a post-pandemic story. There has been a pandemic of some kind. And it is tempting to think that while you were in the hut on the side of Mont Saint-Victoire, Cézanne's mountain, that you were writing this novel. That is not the case. That'd be too easy, wouldn't it?
No, that would be too easy, sadly, because anyone who's lived in a stone shepherd's hut with no electricity, running water or toilet and the roof leaks with two children who are aged 4 and 6 knows
that writing's not at the front of your mind.
You're not going to get that much done except surviving. But the thing was, like, all the time when I was doing the performance stuff and making the visual arts, and every now and then I would say, one of these days, I'm going to write this post-apocalyptic novel. Like, one of these days, I am going to get around to it. But the thing about being in the shepherd's hut, it was kind of like there was this one night where we'd go outside at night, myself and my partner, just to be in like a different physical space to the kids sometimes.
Yeah.
And there was one night we saw, have you seen these Starlink launches that Elon Musk does, where there's all these satellites that go up one after another? Yeah. It's like a chain of lights, like Santa's sleigh or something. It's weird anyway. It's like seeing a CGI effect in real life. And so we didn't know what it was. And we didn't have any internet. And it's the middle of the night. And there was a part of it was like, if you were going to do something weird and military, like, you would do it now, you know?
Is this the end of the world as we know
it? Yeah. And then I was thinking, like, it would actually be really annoying if the world ended before I got around to writing my book about the end of the world. Yeah. So when we got Matt back, Miles, that's my partner, he was just like, just write the book. Stop talking about it and write it.
By the way, when you were in that hut, was Cézanne on your shoulder? Had you any sense of, because I mean, he was obsessed with that mountain.
He was really obsessed with that. It's a beautiful mountain. Like, it's a really beautiful mountain. And not just Cézanne, there's this story about Picasso that the other side of the mountain, apparently one day Picasso phoned up his agent and said, I've bought a Cézanne. And his agent says, there's no Cézannes on the market at the moment. What one did you buy? And Picasso said, I've bought the original, because he bought like half of the other side of the mountain.
Picasso would put it that way.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about the nature of this novel. As I said, there are three. In fact, there's a community of characters here. But I suppose Ozad, I can't see my
face. Odaz.
Odaz, yes. Odaz is an unusual name, who is this young, slightly disenchanted millennial, and the Sarah, who is the midwife. Those, for me, are the two vital characters in the midst of that. And it is interesting that you put the disenchanted millennial with a midwife.
Yeah, well, I think long before I had children, I thought there was something interesting about childbirth after the apocalypse. But it was only having had children that I kind of realised what that might have been. and that in a way is that having children is a kind of apocalypse, in the sense that it's like a cataclysmic change after which nothing is the same again, if you're doing it properly anyway. Mm. and so bringing those two ideas together was part of that. And it's also about, like, what have we got now that's worth preserving? Like, what knowledge have we got? What skills have we got? What have we got that you would really try to carry with you into the future for humanity?
It did strike me, though, as we follow, I'm going to say Ozad again, is it Odaz?
She won't mind. People with funny names, we get used to it.
Yeah, well, you have certainly been granted that. Is it a Welsh name, Gethin?
It is a Welsh name, yes. Yeah. It's also a boy's name generally, but you have to talk to my mum about that.
You've had that
one.
Right with your mother, I would say, several times at this point. But what struck me about this community, because they become a community and they're travelling from London, they're making their way to France to another community that they want to be with, a community that, I'm calling it a birthing community, but certainly a place where giving birth to children is going to be easier now that the society has fallen apart. The sense of community is vital to the story that you're telling.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the thing is that, like, even after the end of the world, like, people are just people. There's a kind of community or domestic side to no matter how extreme the situation is, you're always going to be wondering what you're going to eat and who's going to make it, where you're going to go to the toilet, you know, how are you going to stay warm enough to sleep through the night. Like, in whatever extreme situation, that's often what it's about. And it's often what you don't see in kind of, you know, War of the Worlds or Independence Day.
Well, I was
going to
say that, because what struck me was precisely that. This, you know, you think, oh, post-apocalyptic. And the minute you say that, what do you think? Oh, this is going to be melodramatic. There are going to be flesh-eating zombies, or there's going to be fellas. Now, there are darker characters. They certainly come across another community of people in an hotel where the head honcho there isn't the nicest man in the world. But what you do is you give us the ordinariness of what would be a post-apocalyptic world. You know, as you say, get on with things.
Yeah.
Where am I going to wash my clothes?
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is that, like, most of the stuff that is kind of strangest or scariest or most beautiful about the world, it's just the world. It's just what's already there.
Yeah.
You know, it's just waiting for you to kind of turn your head and see it, really. All the outlandish stuff. It's just there. It's just the world.
What role would you say faith plays in this? Because I talked about a charismatic Dubliner. He's a Rastafarian. Yeah. Why can't I see my... Here it is now. Pressure drop.
Yeah.
The Dublin Rastafarian.
Yeah.
What role would his faith play in that? Because the end of the novel, without giving anything away, if I even read the last three lines, I wouldn't be giving anything away, but it has a feeling of prayer off it.
Yeah, I think the thing is that one of the things I suppose I was interested in was the sort of the necessity of irrationality in situations. There's often this feeling that there's almost a weaponizing of rationality sometimes. That, you know, and in fact, people say rationality when actually what they mean is just an existing power structure propping itself up. And in certain situations, you just have to make a decision and believe in it and go forwards from there. And you can do your best, but in the end, luck is going to play as much of a role as rationality or preparation or anything like that.
And it's the glory be to the Father prayer that is almost there. You slightly shift the words in it. Why that particular prayer? What struck you about it?
I think it's just there's another thread that's running through the whole story, which is about what do we paraphrase and what do we repeat, I suppose. So there are characters who memorize stuff and are able to repeat it, and there are characters who kind of internalize stuff and are then able to paraphrase it, take something that was a structure or something that existed before
and ever so slightly.
Yeah, exactly, make it their own in a different way.
Now
so maybe there's something of that in it.
Now that you've got the debut novel out of the way,
yeah,
is there another one in there bursting to get out?
Maybe, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Should we see how this one goes first? Yeah,
and then up the side of a mountain again into another hut.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at any given chance, to be honest. It's my idea of a holiday.
All right. Water in the Desert, Fire in the Night is the title of Gethin Dick's novel. It's published by Tramp Press, as I said. And Gethin is part of this year's International Literary Festival of Dublin in Merrion Square. Her appearance is at 1 p.m. on Saturday, the 17th of May, with writer Patrick Holloway. Further details on ilf.dublin.com, and you're launching it in Hodges Figgis tomorrow, is it? At what time, 11?
From 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock onwards, Hodges Figgis tomorrow. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Paul Shields and Leah Murphy researched, and the programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.